Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's Ecologic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan, and today we're talking about sailing with one of the most adventuresome people that I've ever met. Liz Clark, or Captain Liz Clark, sailed her boat 20,000 nautical miles and wrote a book about it and all of her adventures and all of her perspectives on the earth and how to care for the earth as well. Really excited to have Liz on the podcast today. Hey, Liz. Great to see you. Welcome to the podcast. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks so much for having me, Ted. It's an honor to be here.
Well, it's my honor. I'm so impressed by you and your adventuresome nature. And where do I find you today? Where are you sitting as we speak?
I'm in French Polynesia, where I live now. I'm settled here for the moment with my sailboat anchored off the bay here.
Mm-hmm. How many years have you been there?
I've been, I started writing my book here in this particular area and then just kind of stayed on. So that was 2015, about 2014. So it's almost been 10 years.
Isn't that incredible?
Crazy, so, you know,
yeah, young woman sails off and ends up in French Polynesia after that's a long sail, isn't it?
yeah, quite an adventure to get here, but yeah, happy and lucky to be here.
You're smiling, I can tell. So let's go all the way back. You grew up on the water. Your father and maybe your mother also, they were avid sailors, right?
Yeah, my father was the sailor. My mom, she went along with it, but it wasn't really her thing. It was more my dad's passion. So he taught me a lot and never really, made any difference between my brother and I. It was always, he taught us equally. He wanted us both involved if we wanted to be. So I was really lucky to have that growing up.
Wonderful, wonderful photo of you in the book, in the early pages of the book. You as a, I think, an eight-year-old kid sailing in a little sailing dinghy, and you have your little dress on, your sunglasses on. You just look as calm as a kid could be sailing around in the, I guess that was in San Diego Bay or Mission Bay or something like that, in San Diego.
Yeah,
then you went up to then you went to UC Santa Barbara, and obviously surfing had become a huge part of your life. You're a competitive surfer, you distinguished surfer, right?
Thank you. Yes. I fell into surfing in my teens and it was really just a love at first feeling type of thing. And went full bore on learning and became competitive in during my college years. And then, but really also enjoyed the exploratory part of surfing and going to look for remote waves and finding the spots where there were less crowds. And that kind of sparked, this idea of combining my sailing background and my passion for surfing and wanting to see the world. The two of them collided into this big idea for a journey, out on the ocean on my own sailboat. And at the beginning, I thought it was going to be a few years, but it turned into a full lifestyle and more than a decade.
Now let's talk about the breadth of where you went. I know with your parents, when you were young, you did a 5,000 mile trip. It sounded like down the coast of Mexico. And then when you took off, you also went south. You started in Santa Barbara and then you went south. And did you go all the way to South America? Then did you cut across all the way across the ocean at that point?
Yes. Yeah. I decided it was, I felt a little safer about staying near the coast as I was gaining confidence as a captain. And I was familiar with the area a bit because we had taken that trip as a family when I was young. So I followed that same path down the coast of Mexico, down Baja, and then mainland Mexico, and then through Central America, got all provisioned and prepped in Panama City, and then sailed west from there.
From Panama?
from Panama, yes. Mm-hmm.
And this wasn't all solo, was it? You had various family and friends and a cat with you at different times.
Yes. Yeah, especially the beginning. You know, I never actually envisioned wanting to sail solo. So, at the beginning I had, you know, back-to-back friends lined up to meet me in different ports and, wanted to have somebody to surf with and extra hands on the boat to help me. And it was only over time that I kind of developed the courage and desire to do some more solo sailing.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you'd be cruising down the coast and then you would find some remote beach and you'd say, hey, look, there's a set of waves over there that looks like we should go check them out.
Yeah, basically. I mean, it's not as easy as it sounds from a sailboat because the speeds that you move at are very slow. So to actually get in and explore the coastlines, it can take a lot of time and you need to have, find safe anchorage before dark or be prepared to, you know, spend the night at sea. And so a lot of times, you know, we would plan for an area where we thought there might be waves around and find a safe anchorage on the charts and, you know, sail directly there. And then with our dinghy, go explore up and down the coastline nearby to find different waves. And that was fairly effective at the time. Like even the chart plotter I had now compared to what's available, it was really simple. So even that, getting in really close to the coastline can be dangerous, you know, that if you don't have really good chart plotter and charting material. So
yeah. So you went from Panama, you went west and across the ocean, and is that, and then to the south Pacific, or where else did you go in this whole 10-year adventure?
So from Panama I sailed west to the Marquesas Islands and then down to the Tuamotu Archipelago and the Society Islands. And then at that point I decided, you know, you only get 3 months on your visa when you come to French Polynesia as an American. And I was just so enchanted by the place that I decided that wasn't long enough and that I didn't want to continue on west of here until I spent a little more time. So at that point I decided to sail north to the Line Islands. And spent a cyclone season up there and then came back here. And from then I've mostly stayed in French Polynesia and done all my sailing right here in this region. But there's still so much I haven't seen, even though it's been a lot of exploring right here.
Huh. Now, how did you provision the boat for, you know, especially the long crossings there across the Pacific? How did you get ready for that? How did you make sure that everything was operable and that you had backup and that you must be adept. You must be like a mechanic. You can work on the engine. You can climb. I've seen the pictures. You climb the mast. How did you get ready for that?
Yeah. You know, I had my mentor, Barry Schuyler, for those first few years. So Barry was, for the listeners, a retired professor at UC Santa Barbara who I crossed paths with in the end of my SB years. And he, at the time, he was looking for someone to sail his boat around the world. And that's really how I was able to, you know, get this sailboat at such a young age. And so during that time where we were, you know, deciding how our arrangement was going to work, some of the requirements that he had were that I needed to apprentice with a local rigger, a local marine mechanic, electrician, you know. So I would follow these guys around all week and learn what they were doing, learn the techniques, how to use the tools, learn the basics of everything that I was going to need to know. Can't learn everything. There's always going to be stuff you don't know, but it really helped prepare me for the equipment failures and all of the obstacles that I would have during the voyage. And so, yeah, I'm so grateful. Yeah. To Barry for having that, you know, that the wisdom to send me with those guys and make sure I knew at least the basics before I headed out to sea.
Very, very wise. And he helped you buy the boat, right?
Yes. Yes. The original boat that he offered me was really small. And I kind of decided that it was going to be not really what I was envisioning. I couldn't really have a friend with me or bring a couple surfboards, you know, it was a tiny boat. So he matched funds for with my dad to help buy a bigger boat. And yeah, so my dad was also very, very instrumental in getting me out there. And then, yeah, Barry helped make sure the boat was safe and poured money into getting it fit for sea.
So, yeah, what do you do to make sure you're all set for that rogue? I always think of the rogue wave that comes and just hits you out of the blue. Or
yeah, it's there's a lot to do. You know, we wanted originally to have everything ready in a year, but it ended up taking almost three to really outfit a sailboat for blue water cruising and big open ocean. You need to look at that boat from stem to stern, from top to bottom, yeah. Check everything. And it all takes time. And you generally open up one thing to find five more projects underneath. And so it took a ton of determination and dedication just to get to the end of those lists and get off the dock. There were moments where I felt that I was never going to make it, you know? Yeah. But at some point you just have to say, you know, I can do whatever's left along the way and I'm ready enough, you know?
Right. Right. It seems, I wrote a bunch of questions down for you, but where did you get the bravery to get out there or was it just the natural thing for you because you've done this as a child with your family? Or I've sailed quite a bit, but I just would not get in a boat right now and go to French Polynesia.
Yeah, I think back now, and sometimes it's hard for me to even believe what I did at such a young age. I think my youth experience definitely equipped me for feeling like it was possible. And sometimes that's all you really need to be able to take that first step and go and get out there. And the rest, you know, of course, there was so many times where I was afraid and where I doubted myself and didn't think that, you know, thought maybe I'd gotten in way over my head. But I learned to kind of like take things in small bites. And, you know, when it became overwhelming or when I felt I didn't have the courage, you know, I just had to like focus on the very next thing that needed to be done or the very next, you know, bit of time that I had to get through. And that was kind of generally how I managed those really scary moments.
I'm envisioning that those are big storms that you're in, and maybe even at night that you're being thrown all around. Were those the worst of it? Is that the worst of it?
Yeah, I think, you know, always at night it's scarier because it's dark and you can't see as well. And, but yeah, there in the tropics, you get, you know, these quick, heavy thunderstorms that pass through. They're violent, but then they're gone fairly quickly. Then you also have, you know, bigger spinning, weather systems that are a little more longer and challenging. But, you know, in general, where I was sailing, I wasn't in like the latitudes that are too dangerous. But, you know, my experiences with lightning, you know, all of that, that's frightening stuff. It's really scary. You're out there and you feel so vulnerable and so small, and
yeah,
there's nowhere to hide, you know.
Did the boat get hit by lightning?
The boat did not get hit by lightning, but I was, I had several very, very close calls. Central America has a lot of lightning, and I think some of my most scary times were there, and then another on my solo passage back from the Line Islands to French Polynesia, got into a really, really scary lightning storm as well.
And how long, what is that distance that we're talking? You said Line Islands down to French Polynesia.
I think it's about, from where I was, it was about 1,700 miles, nautical miles, back to French Polynesia. So it took me 15 days, that passage.
And where is the wind coming from? Are you running with the wind? Are you tacking against the up against a combination of all those shifts
that
all around?
Was particularly a difficult passage. Normally, the trade winds are predicted to be kind of at your side, like at a reach.
Yeah.
We had an early weather event called a Mara'amu, where the trades turn very southeast, and so it became very upwind on that passage for me, which made it really difficult. So it was a particularly difficult passage, but normally it should have been a little bit more off on my beam, and that's how it was when I went up there. But yeah, unfortunately, the way back was quite a challenge. But I could have just turned west and gone like all the other sailors to the next easier destination. But no, I had to come back to French Polynesia. So
a little determination, apparently.
Yeah, I grit my teeth and made it happen.
So where was the best surfing? I mean, you sailed 20,000 nautical miles in search of these remote breaks. Where was the best surf that you found?
That's top secret, Ted.
Oh, is that top secret? Oh, I should have known that. Yeah.
No,
but kill for that. Know, yes.
The thing is, there's good surf everywhere. Everywhere I went, I had great waves. You have to scratch a little below the surface, get a little bit off the beaten path, and my friends and I are, you know, here in French Polynesia, found amazing waves all over the place. So yep. no shortage. It was more, making sure that the boat was functioning properly. It's just finding the time, because, just managing the sailboat and managing, your supplies and the check-ins and check-outs of the countries and, you know, all of that stuff takes time, you know?
Yeah. I was going to say, what was the most challenging aspect of the trip? But it sounds like even just these day-to-day, you got to take care of the boat. You got to deal with customs in these countries. You're not just simply a surfer dude on vacation.
Yeah. Sometimes I would be like, why didn't I just get a backpack and a plane ticket? It would have been so much easier, because man, keeping the sailboat running was always had to be first priority, you know, keep making sure the boat was safe. Just took priority over surfing. Surfing was something to do for fun. But yeah, my whole life, my whole little world was that sailboat. So, first came finding a safe anchorage, making sure the boat was good. And absolutely the most challenging part of the voyage was trying to keep the boat running. And I had really more challenges than most people, thank goodness, because, it was really, I had a lot of extra issues with my boat that normally, you know, everyone has issues, but Swell had some really difficult ones.
I think I read the part where your boat, where you were run into by another boat. just hit you right broadside, dead on, and caused some damage to the hull even.
I was broadsided, but that was kind of the least of my troubles. It was the biggest issue was my, I had this mysterious leak. When I got back from the Line Islands to French Polynesia, my boat was taking on about 6 gallons of water a day. And you couldn't see any hole or any place that it was leaking from the outside. And where I could see the water coming in on the inside of the boat was way up under the engine. So I could only just see a trickle of water and couldn't really see the actual source. And this mysterious leak caused me so much headache. And I ended up in the boatyard for 11 months out of a year and a half following that trip back from the Line Islands. And that was really challenging because boats, all their charm goes away quite quickly when you take them out of the water. Living on one on land is not nearly as fun.
Yeah. So, Yeah, well, their charm goes away also when they're leaking and you're about to go across the ocean.
I mean, it was.
Let me ask you, what are you up to now? I know that in the book you were observing lots of pollution all over, you know, in all the oceans that you saw. What have you been up to since you wrote the book? You're more land based now, obviously. There, you're sitting on a deck.
Yeah. So, I was doing all the environmental advocacy that I was doing while I was on my trip was through social media and kind of raising awareness about different issues through the things that I would encounter on my voyage or lifestyle choices that I was learning and making and kind of bringing people on that journey to try to do better for the planet through my daily choices. When I finished writing Swell, I decided that I really wanted to do something a little more hands-on and a little more focused. And so in the community where I was living and where I met my partner and now husband, we founded a nonprofit called Atia Materia, which is Tahitian for Stand Up for Your Island. And we basically just started to figure out how to come up with solutions for the biggest issues in our community in terms of environmental protection and animal welfare. When my cat that you mentioned before, my cat passed away, and I wanted to do something in her honor, and a lot of people donated in her honor. And so we do a lot of animal welfare as well as environmental protection projects. And that really keeps me busy these days. I'm the director of the nonprofit at the moment, and our team has expanded, and we have so many diverse projects, and I love it. It's so much fun. And we're having positive.
But Liz, no time for sailing.
I know. I'm starting to miss it. I really am. But it felt like I'd been doing this kind of not selfish, but this was my big dream, and I lived it, and I lived it big, and I really just wanted to see what I could do to give back in a more direct way. I'm living that adventure now, and, starting from nothing, never worked in a nonprofit, had no idea how to write a grant application and those types of things. And so it's been fun. I just needed a kind of a different new challenge. And I think that the ocean will call again, and there will be a time to get back out there.
You still have Swell, the same boat.
I still have Swell, yeah. Swell
bobbing out at anchor as we speak.
Yeah. And she, when I need to feel grounded isn't the right word, maybe centered. I go out there and spend time on her. And she always is a source of strength and reminds me who I am and where I came from, you know.
Really, yeah, when, and your book, you know, your title of your book, Swell, of course, but A Sailing Surfer's Voyage of Awakening. And so it seems like that those 10 years, like you said, it was almost selfish, but I wouldn't call it that. But that's the way you expressed it. It's like you took that time on the ocean and on the water to find yourself, right? I mean, like you said, you went to the ocean to get grounded, and now you're awake, and then you're on to the next chapter.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like being on the ocean, and especially the time that I spent solo, it really sped up my internal growth. It was like I'd have these moments on land and immersed in social activities in a bay or wherever, and then I'd have this time at sea where I was just alone. It was just me and the ocean. And all this time to reflect on, you know, where I was in my life and who I want to be. And I think it accelerated that self-awareness that I didn't find the space and time for that in my land life prior to my voyage. And that time just allowed me to learn who I am, learn what I love, hear my instincts better, and all of that applied to my way of interacting with people on land, the choices I made for my future, even just, you know, for my health, like being able to listen to my body and, all of those things. I don't know if they would have happened as quickly in a land life setting, because I even feel it now as I'm here. I'm so swept into the rush of being connected to the internet all the time and, running this nonprofit that's doing so many amazing things, but gives me much less time to focus in and hear my own inner voice, you know.
Oh, very interesting. Hey, listen, thanks so much for sharing your perspectives. What an amazing perspective that you have, set of perspectives that you have and that you've shared with us. It's really been a pleasure to hear a little bit about your story and to have read some of your book. I'm going to read the whole thing now. It's a great read. So awesome. Thanks, Liz.
Thanks, Ted. Thanks for all you do.
That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.